Welcome to Under Lock and Key, news and commentary about prisons from the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist League and the Maoist Internationalist Movement.
The growth of prisons hurts children. Mamia Abu Jamal explains how the prison system takes away hope from prisoners.
The U.S. incarcerates a greater percentage of its population than any other country, sending more black men to prison than college. The purpose of this program is to educate about and inspire activism against the American lockdown.
1.5 million children in the United States have a parent in prison, according to a Justice Department report released in August. This is a 60% increase in 9 years, paralleling the 62% increase in prisoners during the 1990s. Children of prisoners are 3.4% of all children. Imprisonment in the U.S. is a tool of social control used by the ruling class against oppressed nations and activists. This is just one part of a whole system of unequal education, economic opportunities, and discrimination that keeps oppressed nations from gaining equality in the U.S. These statistics demonstrate the far-reaching effects of imprisonment. It is not just the men and women locked up who are affected. Whole families are torn apart, and already disadvantaged youth face life without a parent. The prison system is not set up to rehabilitate. If it was, it would encourage contact with families, one of the few factors that have been shown to reduce recidivism under our current system. But most prisoners are housed far from their families. As of 1997, 62% of state prisoners and 84% of federal prisoners were held more than 100 miles from their last place of residence. For families already facing financial hardship, the travel required to see their imprisoned relatives becomes impossible. The impact of placing more than 1 in 4 black men in the criminal injustice system extends far beyond these individual men. The effect is that the criminal injustice system is a self-perpetuating system. No amount of reformist effort will eliminate the national oppression within U.S. borders. The November Coalition recorded a message about a child whose father is in prison as part of a CD entitled Voices from the Drug War. The November Coalition can be contacted on the World Wide Web at www.november.org.
Hi, my name is Selena Kingsley, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about how the war on drugs has affected our family. In 1995, in two separate court dates, my husband was sentenced to a total of 20 years in prison for dealing in methamphetamine. But we were stunned, just putting it mildly. We didn't understand mandatory minimums. You know, we were just numb. We had no idea that he was going to get that kind of sentence for such a small amount of crank. 2 weeks later, we kind of got slapped in the face by reality because that's when we found out I was pregnant. It was such an emotional thing. On one hand, all we could think about was what he and the baby would miss out, what I would have to go through on the outside by myself. On the other hand, it was a blessing because we had such a long sentence in front of us, and I could very conceivably be too old to have any kids by the time he came home. JJ was born in January of 96, and due to telephone restrictions, he was 3 hours old before his daddy knew he was born. JJ's really the focus of my story. He's 28 months old now, and he is identical to his daddy in looks, temperament, and actions. It alternately warms my heart and breaks it. Of all the damage that's been done, the damage to him is the greatest, I think. JJ loves to go bye-bye to Dad's house. He was 12 days old the first time he went through shakedown. I keep a whisker basket full of pictures. You can literally see our baby growing up in cheap Polaroids taken by the state. Even at his age, he knows the routine. A few weeks ago, we were in the grocery store, and there was a state trooper in uniform. JJ went up to him with a big smile, and the cop bent down to talk to him, and JJ outstretches his arms because he associates the uniform with getting shaken down. I started crying right in the store and just led him away. You know, the pain just doesn't stop. At our facility, we wait in a glass-damned room until my husband comes in from the back. JJ stands with his little face pressed right against the glass, watching each offender until that magical moment when Daddy appears. Then against all the rules, he's flying out the door, his little chubby arms outstretched, hollering, "JJ's Dad." The guards can't help but smile at him. We do our best to make, you know, visits our family time. We can't take any toys in, so they spent like hundreds of hours making paper airplanes, choo-choo trains out of Snicker bars, threading paper towels through lifesavers to make cars. But all too soon, our name's called and it's time to leave. And JJ doesn't understand why Daddy can't come home. A lot of times at the end of a visit, I'll carry him away and he'll be screaming, "No, no, bye-bye, Dad, no, no." The guards turn their heads like they're ashamed. His daddy dies another silent death, and I carry him away crying.
Mamiya Abu-Jamal is a former Black Panther on death row. He was framed for the righteous killing of a police officer engaged in an act of police brutality. He was sentenced to death in 1982 after a bogus trial. His appeals are now in the much quicker federal courts, and execution could happen very soon. Prior to his arrest, Mamiya was a radio journalist who exposed police brutality. From within the walls, through books, articles, and radio commentaries, Mamiya continues to be an outspoken leader of the oppressed. With Mamiya's access to the media limited, we recorded one of his essays to bring it to a wider audience. See for yourself the real reason why the state of Pennsylvania wants to kill Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
Killing Time by Mamiya Abu-Jamal. Time is as elusive as a thief, silent as death. Only later does it appear, on the day you look into a burnished metal slab, solidly riveted to a cell wall, and ask, "Who is that old man?" For most prisoners, time is oppressive and liberating. At the beginning of a sentence, time stretches ahead, almost insurmountable in its height, almost unreachable in its distance. At the sentence's midpoint, time seems more navigable, for the time one has to do is measured by the time one has already done. Toward the end, time becomes a sweet promise. For the 3,219 men and women on death row in the United States, there is no time. There is no light at the end of the tunnel, only darkness. Not surprisingly, some people flee from this horrific emptiness into the embrace of psychotropics. Thorazine, Prolixin, and Haldol are readily available from the shrinks and prison pharmacy to render inmates insensate to timelessness. So are illegal drugs, which are merely a channel change that leads to the same oblivion. Others plunge into the riddled realm of religion, making a way to the world to come as they are being ushered out of this one. Some, for similar reasons, dabble in the occult. In prison, time is intentionally dragged to a crawl by intense regimentation. Meals take place at a certain time. Shaves are scheduled for a certain hour. The institution strives to create a routine that differs little from day to day. This schedule serves to deaden one's perception of time. For under such a regimen, what makes one day differ from another? The hypnotic sameness makes it appear as if every day is like the day that came before, and every week an echo of the week that preceded it, and every month the same, and every year the same. The same, the still, unchanging same. In prison, time is a thick, dull mallet that pounds consciousness into a coma. Is it any wonder, then, that the men and women who are blessed to emerge from these hellholes are often stunned by the dizzying pace of life in the free world? They leave a dark place where time crawled and are expected to find a meaningful, productive niche in a social order that races at bawd rates and dances to the surging rhythms of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Is it any wonder that so many soon flee to this deceptive relief of recidivism? Time is a burden, a blur, a blessing. Still, for at least some of the imprisoned, time can be a friend. For them, it is a space to study, learn, and unlearn that which is helpful to interpret life's misery. The prison becomes a school, and the cell is transformed into a classroom. For them, time can be liberating. Dr. James Gilligan, a Massachusetts State Prison psychiatrist, has written, "While several anti-recidivism programs had worked, the most successful of all, and the only one that had been 100% effective in preventing recidivism, was the program that allowed inmates to receive a college degree in prison. But some states, Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, for example, have terminated their prison college programs because they see them as gifts to prisoners. In so doing, they have stripped inmates of the one worthwhile use of time." How politically driven institutions like prisons treat time is the clearest reflection of the social order's deepest and truest concerns. When what works gets sacrificed to what is politically popular, time becomes leadened, deadened, and illogical. Such a short-sighted approach is itself a crime, one that will become manifest in time. Written by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The federal prison system kills. This is a letter from a federal prisoner in Florence, Colorado. "The merciless and imperialist scheme that rips off taxpayers in the name of the Federal Bureau of Prisons is killing prisoners at the ADX Supermax at the rate of nearly 2 per year. Since the opening of this man-made hell in 1994, mysterious deaths linked with medical negligence have killed E. Gray Kaufman, who injured his own head during an epileptic seizure and was permitted to bleed to death while staff stood and watched, Henry Evans, who had a mysterious heart attack in his cell, Leroy Martin, D. Jones, who became ill in his cell, was taken out around 4 a.m. by prison officials and pronounced dead shortly thereafter. And now there is the most recent mysterious death of Wilson, who was pronounced dead of suicide in his own suicide-proof cell." That was a letter from a prisoner in Colorado. This letter from a Texas prisoner tells prisoners how to unite. "First of all, allow me to clench fist salute my MIM comrades for your continued devotion to this mass struggle. I've been away only in pen, but not in heart. I have a message for all my black and Latino comrades throughout the U.S., confined to these lockdown control units, to put your family differences aside, band together with your resources to enhance this struggle. The prison administration likes to call our family members security threat groups or gangs, and all of you are making their job so easy by fighting each other. And for what? I don't want to hear that stuff about how he disrespected us, or that color flag stuff. These pig devils will beat you down and have you afraid to come out of your cells, and very few of us will even file a grievance or complaint. Yet we will stab and beat each other down in a heartbeat. My Latino comrades stopped the war. My black comrades stopped the war. Why are you all, and me, making it so easy for Governor Bush to ask and get more of our poor, hard-working families' tax dollars to build more of these new millennium plantations? If you'll see a pig slam or beat somebody down, it's your business. Ask for a witness form and file it, then file a grievance complaint. I know a lot of you all think the grievance system is a joke, and I tend to agree, but the courts have limited our rights, and the trick is to file in numbers. They are so slick here in Texas that they have now limited the number of grievances we can file from 3 a week to 1 every 7 days. Together we are strong, and we got to stop looking the other way, because sooner or later, it'll be your turn to get lied on, slammed, and beat down. For my comrades here in Texas Administrative Segregation, write your unit law library for the new Administrative Segregation Plan and fill out a law book form and request Ruiz versus Gary Johnson Memorandum Opinion and read them. We have to empower ourselves with knowledge, and when I say stop the wars, I mean all my East, West, North, and South comrades in struggle." That was a letter from a Texas prisoner in administrative segregation. This has been Under Lock and Key, a revolutionary anti-imperialist league and Maoist internationalist movement program about prisons. For more information, contact RAIL, P.O. Box 712, Amherst, Massachusetts, 01004, or email radio@mim.org.